Still, Queer as Folk. Tonight, Brian meets the parents, Michael plays it straight to get promoted, and Justin plays with some jambalaya. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Babylon Boomerang.
It first aired on Showtime in the U.S. on February 4th, 2001.
It was directed by Steve DeMarco and written by Richard Kramer. He wrote episode 4, Ted's Not Dead, and also wrote a bunch of 30-something episodes and my so-called life episodes. We liked this guy the last time he wrote an episode for us.
Because he didn't kill Ted.
Might as well have. 20 minutes of screen time of coma.
Synopsis of Babylon Boomerang. Kicked out of his house and taunted at school, Justin moves in with the extremely reluctant Brian, who test drives a Jeep through a showroom window when a salesman makes a homophobic remark.
We got all the spoilers in this.
Yeah, right? Just gives away the thing. Meanwhile, Michael goes on a date with his coworker, Tracy, in order to secure a promotion, but feels guilty for being dishonest. Well, no shit, Michael.
So that's the episode. I guess we're done.
That's it, everybody. Good night.
This episode is really about Michael moving his career along and Justin moving along his relationship with Brian. Both of those come with a cost, though. Michael has to lie to do it, and Justin has to tell the truth about himself to do it. So we get to see the impact of Justin's story, but Michael's doesn't fully play out in this episode. It unfolds over a couple more episodes. Eventually, this story is really about just being honest and true to yourself as seen through the eyes of Michael and Justin.
Good way to put it. Especially when I think Justin lives his truth a lot more than Michael does.
Yeah. Justin's out and proud. Michael's in and not proud.
Trying to think of something clever, but
so let's go in and not proud to the big Q where we kick things off in this episode.
So they're in that very cramped locker room.
Oh yeah. That was,
there was no space in that thing.
They just had to prop those lockers up just for this one scene and then roll them out of there because we never see that set again.
it was sad, honestly.
Tracy ends up pimping Michael for Mr. Barbarossa's manager job of the Big Q because at first Michael wasn't going to apply for the job, and Tracy starts to warm him up to that idea. And Michael, of course, has no ambition to do anything then what he's doing right now. So Tracy really flexes her muscles here as a lever to show Michael that there's a little bit more. And I liked a little bit of the tension there because she was giving Michael something and Michael was keeping something back. So there was a nice little dichotomy there that worked well.
Right. I mean, here we're just introduced to the idea that a promotion is available, but we've also heard in previous episodes that Michael's not interested in having that much extra responsibility. He sort of just wants to get through it.
Yeah, he's like one of those people that you see in their hookup profile that's looking for whatever that comes their way. They don't really have an ambition. They don't say, I'm a photographer or I'm a theater director. They're looking for whatever comes their way. And I think that's kind of how we see Michael, where he goes to work. He goes to the Big Q, he does his thing, and he takes the money. And it's not really, you know, his passion in life or anything like that. So why would he have any ambition?
Yeah, why would you make working at the Big Q your passion? Apparently for Mr. Barbarossa, it must be a passion, but...
Yeah, he's clearly been there since the beginning of time. It's about time that he got promoted to the statewide manager so he can manage all of Pennsylvania.
Right. And next thing you know, we're at Babylon.
Boom.
Just boom, Babylon. I've watched this episode twice. I honestly can say I do not remember Emmett getting spanked.
It started out in the scene where he's just kind of bent over and everybody's just taking a whack at him. That was really funny. And Justin comes in and Emmett cuddles right up to him. And this is, again, a little bit of a disconnect between where this character is in relation to all of the other people. He's alternately being outcast and shooed away by Brian, and then at the same time, fully embraced by other people. It's kind of weird.
I never know how these people are taking Justin. On one hand, they're incredibly annoyed by him. On the other hand, he's just a part of the gang.
Yeah, and maybe it's they like him when everybody's been drinking and they just can't tell the difference. Oh, yeah,
they just don't think anything of it. They're like, eh, the kid's all right.
Something I noticed here is that this is episode 8, and so far we haven't really had an Emmett storyline. Emmett is a little bit of the jester so far.
Yeah, the closest we've gotten was, I've already forgotten his name. The Japanese hustler.
Oh, what was his name? Katsu.
Katsu.
Kane.
Yeah, the closest we've gotten to any type of Emmett storyline was Katsu. and even then, that was like in arguably the funniest episode we've seen so far.
And it was really just slapstick kind of filler material.
It was a silly entertainment, mixed up identity type of story.
Yeah, like nothing kept with the jester nature of Emmett so far. And I am eagerly awaiting a Emmett drama storyline so that we can really see what Peter Page can do with that. Meanwhile, everybody leaves Babylon altogether, mysteriously. We've never seen that really happen unless they have some lines to deliver to each other. And Justin's dad, Craig Taylor, appears out of nowhere and bam, drops Brian with one punch.
Oh, no, he just starts assaulting him. Yeah. And I'm like, you are doing this literally in the middle of a crowd. Dude is super lucky that no one else called the cops.
Well, if you remember, Justin also dropped Chris Hobbs with one punch. So like father, like son across two episodes. Brian goes down. He's on the ground. Craig Taylor is kicking him and really just attacking him. And there is a really, really nice, caring and real moment between Brian and Justin. While Brian's being beat up, Justin's trying to help him. They finally get him away. And he has this cute little line, like, he was hurting you. And the scene really came together with that because Justin, for the first time, was able to try to offer a measure of protection to Brian.
In this scene, there's a lot to unpack because Brian wants to retaliate in some way, but he's being held back and he's being told that that's Justin's father. So he knows he can't really do anything. And then Craig gives an ultimatum mm-hmm. to Justin, which is you either come home now or you're never coming home again. And then that sparks something in Brian. Brian, like, that infuriates Brian more than anything. Like,
yeah.
He has to shove himself away from the crowd.
That's it. If you come home with me right now, or you never come home again.
As soon as it became conditional for Brian, that's the trigger point for him, where he sees that somebody is being made to choose between their sexual identity and their home life. Those are the trigger points for him.
Justin makes a very, very, very clear decision that he is taking I'm not coming home ever.
It was a little of a non-decision decision though. I mean, in that moment,
that's true.
You really only have one choice.
Yeah. In that moment, he was like, of course I'm never coming home again because you just assaulted the person that I've been fucking.
I'm never coming home again. Never!
Justin.
Fucking never!
When we get to Brian's apartment and it's him and Justin, Justin's like, I'm going to head out. Like, without a second thought, he doesn't try to force Brian to let him stay. Brian asks, where are you going to go? And he said, somewhere.
Yeah.
But Brian says, you can stay.
It seems a little out of character for Brian, but under the circumstances, it's almost
understandable. And he says, you can stay on the couch.
Are you coming and going? Or are you coming and going? I'm sorry, wrong episode.
Right. Once again, he relegates him to the couch. This is where we have two underwear checks of the episode.
Ooh, underwear check.
Yes, the first one, I believe, is Brian. Brian's getting into bed. Now, he still has his tank top on, but I believe he's down to a pair of briefs.
Yeah, he had on cute little black briefs. They might have been trunks, but I think they were briefs.
Yeah. And then we see Justin undressing. He gets down to his briefs.
Those briefs.
Let's talk about those briefs.
They are kind of purplish gray. And
how do they fit on him?
They were pretty astonishing because we got a very good look at Randy Harrison's junk for the first time. And I think you saw his junk on stage before, didn't you?
I've seen the rear on stage. Oh. When I saw him in the national tour of Cabaret at the end of Act One, the MC at that time, played by Randy Harrison, exposes his ass, and in a very jarring moment, it's his ass that has the Nazi symbol on it.
Oh,
so the one thing I did notice with looking at Randy Harrison in his underwear is I feel like the back was filled out rather nicely. I was kind of surprised for someone who is pretty short. His rear end is very well rounded.
Yeah, it was a very good scene. So.
But in this moment, he's gotten undressed, and
I don't like how Brian just keeps putting him on the sofa because they've hooked up dozens of times so far, and yet Brian is always doing this little dominant thing by putting him on the right. sofa.
Well, and here, Justin makes a very clear decision of, I'm going to get into bed with you.
Yeah.
And can we talk about the music choice here?
Madonna, Don't Tell Me, was playing underneath this scene. And I did a check on the Netflix version and the Showtime streaming version. And it is this ghastly piece of music. And once again, the entire music supervision for the series is wrecked by streaming rights.
This is like the first time like even I could clock what the song was and who the artist was.
Yeah.
Normally it is like
they're a little obscure.
Yeah, usually they're a little more obscure, but like this I was like, this is a very mainstream song to be playing.
Oh, and it totally made the scene.
Yeah,
it was perfect.
It totally worked. And so I was like,
they spent some budget on this one.
Right there. That was a third of their budget was just to get that one Madonna song.
Yeah. It was cute though. I like that scene.
Yeah, because he gets into bed, he crawls into bed, and I love the fact that Justin's thinking, like, I'm just going to sneak in. I'm like, he went to bed literally 3 seconds ago. He is not asleep yet. He knows you're getting into bed. And Brian looks over and just leaves it as it is. And it was really nice.
I think he put a little bit of the blanket over him, too.
Yeah.
There was some place in this scene where we had words of wisdom from Debbie. I think that should be, like, another topic that we revisit. Words of wisdom from Debbie.
Oh, that's like a whole mini-sode.
Yeah.
Before they get to the, before they return to Brian's loft, they're recounting.
They had to have a bite to eat.
Yeah,
first.
They go to the diner and they're recounting the story of when Craig beat up Brian, and Justin is retelling it like he came in and rescued Brian and saved the day, like he's beating up his dad too. And he gets a little shit for it from Ted and Emmett for embellishing the story. But Debbie is right. It's like this poor kid is traumatized.
Oh, is this your idea of some evening entertainment? This poor child's been fucking traumatized watching his father go berserk like that. And as for you, I told you there'd be trouble and you didn't listen.
She had that really funny line that went, Justin's parents aren't ready to think of him sucking cock and taking it up the ass.
Right. And everyone is like kind of chuckling at it. But then she like loses her train of thought. And they're,
but then she
like,
fainted.
And then, well, she goes to pick up the tray. She's like, God, I'm exhausted. I've been working since 6 a.m. And Emilia, she loses like her grip and goes down. Like Wendy Williams on live TV, and and she loses her wig. So we now know that that shocking curly red hair is a wig.
In full Debbie mode, she's on the ground and Michael's down there helping her, and he's obviously distraught. And she just says, "I swallowed my gum."
I swallowed my gum.
I would love to know if that was in the script or if Sharon Gless just dropped that in. There's also some intercuts here where Craig and Jennifer are arguing. So Craig Taylor has gone back to the Taylor estate in suburbia.
Estate. I love that.
And it's another awesome suburban mom scene from Sherry Miller.
Continues to bring it in this series.
I love
her. Once again, she's asking the hard questions. What the hell were you thinking? I wasn't. Well, obviously.
Yeah.
And, he reveals that he gave him an ultimatum and Justin made his choice. And she's like, I want nothing to do with you.
Right.
And I was like, you banish him from the bedroom, Jennifer Taylor.
So suddenly everybody's taking Debbie home.
Right. So. So we come home, and Vic is incredibly distraught because it's clear that she is overworked, and she's doing it, as Vic claims, all for him.
Yeah. Well, Vic did spend all the money when he thought he was going to die.
Right. But that fills him with guilt, and he reveals to Michael that she's taking all these shifts for him, and she's taking out a second mortgage on the house. Really makes you feel for someone who was never meant to survive.
Right, right.
You know, and it's really heartbreaking. But something that then develops throughout this episode is, and I really love it, it's the sibling love that exists between Vic mm-hmm. and Debbie. We definitely get hints of it in the previous episodes, but here is where we really start to see it fleshed out.
Yeah, there was a funny, I don't know if you saw it, but Ted was throwing shade at Justin in this, where they're trying to get Debbie to stay home and get bed rest and everything, and Vic's throwing in his barbs to Debbie. Then Ted just throws out there,
"Thank you, Doogie Howser."
It's like, Ted, stop bullying him.
Ted's got a real sass mouth as of late.
He did.
One little coma, and he's just reading everyone for filth.
It's a coma, and the drug-addled twink named Blake, I don't know where he gets his balls from. And then the rooster crows, and it's morning. So where else would we be other than the diner, where the costuming on Brian was atrocious,
It's atrocious on both Brian and Michael.
Brian has on a red shirt with a red tie.
Ugh.
And I think that was just appalling, even for 2001 when this was airing.
Right. And Brian is basically futzing over what car to get, you know, and since the Jeep has been totaled by Craig Taylor, he's got to get a new car. So he's like, you know, I could always trust the Jeep. I could get an Audi. I'm like, ugh.
Meanwhile, on the opposite side of that is Michael, who realizes that he needs to be supporting his mother and giving his mother some money. So Brian's in spend mode and Michael is in I need to save and spend on my mother mode. And then Brian offers Michael money and he's suddenly generous with him, which I don't know is that we've seen that generosity streak in Brian.
Well, that's revealed by Michael, though. He's like, you're always protecting me from bullies. You're always giving me an answer to the tasks. And like, so we're established that Brian has been a protector of Michael. And so he's like, you know, he tries to be discreet too mm-hmm. with Michael. You know, he tries to whisper like, if you need something, I've had a really great year.
Yeah.
And Michael stands up and, okay, now let's talk about Michael's wardrobe choice here because
I didn't take any notes on his. I just was blinded by the red.
The pants are like high-waisted, so we now give Michael no torso. And then because of that, the tie that he's wearing is like hanging down to like his crotch. And I'm looking at him like, are you a child who is playing dress up? Because what is going on with you?
He at least needs to drop into a full Windsor to take up some of the slack on the tie.
Seriously, rethink the tie choice. I don't know how they do things at the Big Q.
Speaking of the Big Q, well, while Brian is offering Michael money, where is Dr. David in all this? Where's his sugar daddy in the off?
It's only been 4 days. I don't know if you can ask him for money yet.
But he's not even in the scene. There wasn't any mention of him. He wasn't out. You just never hear anything about him. And as soon as Brian was offering Michael money, it just made me think, where is this guy? He shows up later, but it was just kind of like this weird casting event. Maybe he wasn't available that day.
He wasn't on the call sheet.
Another schoolyard scene.
Yes. So Justin is walking with Daphne and he's recounting the events with his father and all the things he did last night. And she's like, and he's like, so what did you do, Daphne? And Daphne's like, I did my homework. That's it.
Suddenly these two best of friends have no idea what's going on.
No, and Jennifer shows up as professional suburban mom that she is.
I love it when she shows up at the schoolyard.
Right. She hands him his suit, dry cleaned,
oh, yeah.
And his backpack so he can go to school. And, you know, she says, I want you to come back home. But Justin lashes out at Jennifer.
Stop picking on her.
Seriously, Justin, stop being a little shit. I know things are rough with your dad, but it's not Jennifer's fault.
Because we're on Team Jennifer here.
Oh, hashtag Team Jennifer. Let's make that trend.
That's right. There's a quick cut over to Debbie trying to get back on her feet, and she's wearing this amazing leopard print, like, kind of moo-moo. Onesie.
It's so great. And, you know, and she doesn't have her wig on. And he's like, you're supposed to be resting or you're supposed to be taking a nap. She's like, yeah. It's like, they're supposed to be short. That's why it's a short word. And I was like, I love it.
That was a little transitional scene to give Jennifer time to get to Brian's office.
Oh. Well, no, I won't say it was just transitional. I will say, because again, this is where we start to see the sibling love and the relationship that they've had for a long time. Because Debbie wants soup and Vic is like, he tries to make it for her, and they actually work together to make it happen. And it was a really cute scene. In her muumuu. I love that.
Great costuming there.
Yes.
Not so much with Brian, but.
But yes. So Jennifer.
Here's where Jennifer crushes it.
Oh, God. Like power suburban mom comes in. It's like Brian Kinney, Jennifer Taylor.
Was this the first time that she ever spoke to Brian?
I think so.
They were at the art opening at the Gay and Lesbian Center.
Right, but she ran off before she said anything.
Yeah, so they never actually met. She just had that little weird fantasy view of her son being bent over the piano that Roger was playing and getting pounded.
And she does like owns the entire thing. Doesn't let him get a word in edgewise. She drops off his duffel bags. She says, you know, here's his Yellow Submarine VHS. He watches it all the time. And oh, she's just like, guess what? He's your problem now.
I like how Brian was trying to just quickly dismiss her. And she has that line, you fucked him.
Oh, yes, he is. You seduced him. Fucked him, so now he's yours.
And she stops before saying you fucked him. It's like she was like, wait a minute, I gotta get this guy.
Yeah.
You
what do I have in my purse to whack him?
Right. Over she that went with you fucked him. And I was like, go Jennifer.
I
was like cheering watching.
Brian looked so uncomfortable, and I really loved the tension.
Oh,
that
she's so got
Jennifer
him.
Created with that. Go Sherry Miller.
And she gives him money. She's like, he's a kid. He's expensive.
Yeah.
She's like, oh my God, you're amazing.
While all this is going on, Michael, of course, is at the big queue, and Bob Barbarossa
is singing Italian opera.
Oh, right.
He's singing Italian opera, and Michael, ready to get his nose very firmly brown, realizes he's got to go after this promotion.
Yeah.
And has to kiss some major ass.
Now that Debbie is just about dropped dead in the diner. So Bob Barbarossa has that great line there, bring your lady, which proved to be the line that put Michael into crisis mode. So he's like, my lady. So he starts to, in a conversation with Andrew, his coworker, who's also up for the job, and with Brian, they're talking about how he really needs like a beard to bring to this party for his boss. And I thought about this, about whether this is something that would really go on now. And I don't think I would do that. I don't think I would bring a stunt date to it.
No, this is where... And when we get to Barbarossa's party too, that whole sequence was so positively 1950s-ish, know? It reminded me a lot of the movie Far From Heaven, like when they have a party and they bring all of his coworkers over. Like, I was like, this feels...
30-something.
Richard
Kramer, 30-something.
An entirely different time period.
Yeah, it was really, really out of sync. And even, like, the name, how did they come up with this guy's name? Bob Barbarossa.
I don't know. Sometimes I think they just have a wheel of, like,
the wheel
letters.
Of names.
Yeah, and they spin and see what happens.
Yeah. Fortunately, we get to see another social gym scene. We haven't had one of those for a while. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion there other than Michael getting his beard arranged, but there was some cute Emmett things going on here. Emmett's bucket hat was back that you hated.
It's in a different color.
Yeah, he's
that
got several.
That means he has multiples of these.
Yeah.
And I have a real problem with that.
The funniest thing I saw was that every exercise that Emmett was doing was focused on his butt. He was really like,
well,
making it bubble up.
I mean, when you know what your position is, you gotta show off your best asset.
So back at Brian's loft, Justin's on his Blonde Ambition tour, dancing around. He's wearing Brian's clothes. He's got his Walkman on. Daphne's on the phone yelling out things like, are you guys fucking?
Yeah, for someone who loves to claim that he is an adult and he is, you know, he's almost 18, he's going to be able to vote and get married and all this stuff. He is such a fucking kid.
Yeah, he was like all of a sudden... like his real age. He's in teenager mode again.
Yeah, he thinks like, I have no responsibilities. I can be like, I can stay up late. I don't have to do my homework. I don't have to go to school. I'm like, get the hell over yourself. There's such an invasion of Brian's life when Justin abuses the invitation to stay. You know what I mean?
I don't know is that he is abusing it. He was just being a teenager. And as soon as Brian gets home, Justin goes into full-on boyfriend mode. And
as long as we're together. Oh, yeah. Shut up.
Oh, I loved it. I loved how much he was yearning for it. And it was...
considering the last episode opened with like, I don't do boyfriends.
You're right.
And he's all like lovey-dovey now. I'm like...
I could understand Ryan's point if I came home even to a house guest, like tearing up the place like that, I would feel the same way.
Eating you out of house and home. I mean, oh my God.
No pun intended.
You're welcome for that setup.
So there's another quick shot to Vic and Debbie's house. And there was a nice little slapstick moment where Debbie's trying to escape out the front door.
Right, she's in full uniform, the wig's back on.
Yeah.
She's trying to hustle for the door, and Vic's like saying, no, you can't.
Vic was waiting for her. He knew exactly what was going on. And he just about wrestles her to the ground.
Get out of those clothes and back in your muumuu.
If I have to watch Martha Stewart make one more goddamn thing out of goat cheese, I'm going to kill myself.
The scenes between Debbie and Vic, Sharon Gless and Jack Weatherall, are really, really good. I don't think we've seen a bad one yet. A lot of times Vic is almost like the comedic barb of the scene, but it really plays off into the other characters and they really respond to it in ways that are unexpected. And it really carries the story in a way that makes people laugh.
The way we're introduced to Vic is that we have such a feeling of foreboding, and you know, he's a character that is living in a sort of depression, that to see that there's a lot of love and sibling back and forth really lightens his character.
So let's go car shopping with Lindsay and Brian. Brian, like since Brian got beat up like half an hour ago, which is really like 2 days ago, he's still like clutching his ribs the entire time.
He probably has broken ribs, but because he thinks he's immortal, he doesn't want to deal with it.
Yeah, they're just trying to oversell it a little, though. It's like, we know he got beat up. We know he's hurt. He doesn't have to like clutch his ribs. Right. He can just kind of grimace once in a while or something like that.
And he's at this dealership. He's, of course, looking at a Jeep.
Yeah.
And he has Lindsay and Gus with him, and they decide to have a little, to me, it seems like they decided to have like a little fun with the salesman. Cause you know, he made a comment about like what a beautiful family he has. And she's like, yes, we have four of them just like him at home. Yeah. And I was like, Lindsay,
she's just squeezing those babies out.
And so
did you catch what the salesman said to Brian?
Oh, hell yes.
Only you don't really want this.
I don't.
Fags drive it.
The line didn't make any sense. Fags drive Jeeps. It's like, no, they don't. I don't know any that do.
Is that a
rugged off-roading vehicle.
Is it like a
Midwestern type of thing?
I don't know. But
Central Pennsylvania thing? Yeah,
apparently only fags drive these types of Jeeps.
I never understood
like
that.
You want a full-size sedan for your family. And I'm like, is the sale better with the full-size sedan than it is with the Jeep? But the main point of it is that the salesman uses the idea that you don't want to drive a Jeep unless you want to look like a homosexual.
Even in the UK edition, Stewart drove a Jeep. I don't know where this Jeep thing comes from.
I literally don't either.
So let's go for a test drive. Brian gets into the Jeep, and suddenly it's no longer inside the showroom. It's outside.
Right. Somehow he gets outside the showroom.
It's magic.
And he, you know, he gives a little wink to the salesman who's on the phone, and he then guns it into the middle of the showroom.
Ugh.
And asks Lindsay, honey, what do you think? We'll take it.
I thought this scene was ridiculous.
It was. I'm sorry. There's a lot of unanswered questions. Like, who's going to pay for that damage? I'm assuming they called the cops, because I would if someone, some maniac did that, drove a vehicle into the, especially with Gus right there, that was an incredibly dangerous thing. If I were Lindsay, I would be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You could have killed your kid.
I just don't see like Brian going to that level after being run down by Craig Taylor, by being beaten up by Craig Taylor, and his response to being called a fag driving a Jeep is to drive the Jeep through the window.
Yeah, it's the whole thing.
It was just too over the top.
Yeah.
Didn't need to be there. And the whole scene could have just ended with the salesman saying, fags drive Jeeps. And having that just linger and having maybe a two shot of Lindsay and Gus coming around the corner. That's all it took. It didn't need that stunt. They had to hire stuntmen for that. So let's talk about the scene that I know you've been waiting all night for.
So Dr. David Cameron and
Deep
Michael.
Breath. Do you need a sip of wine first?
Hold on 1 second.
I'll admit that this scene got my attention for once with Dr. David Cameron.
Who is on top of Michael going, oh, you're tight.
God, you're tight.
Thanks.
And we see that Dr. David Cameron is just giving him a back massage, but the initial angle, it looks like he is dick deep. And
Michael's like all oiled up. And once again, he's got his bubble butt up in the air. So I think in the last episode where he saw his bubble butt outdoors, I think the directors might have seen that and go, oh, hey, we got something here. We should use this more often. And there's an underwear check here. Dr. David is wearing two Exist briefs.
And filling them out nicely.
But he is straddling Michael and his bubble butt. He's oiled up. Why does he have his underwear on? I need to know this.
It's quite possible that Dr. David Cameron had something in his writer, in his 21-page nudity writer, that it was forbidden for him to be fully nude in this scene.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? It was shot from the front also, so they couldn't do any frontal nudity in that particular thing, so they had to put a loincloth of two Exist briefs over him.
That's fine. It did the job either way.
Did you pick up on that little like quadruple slap that he gave to Michael's ass?
Oh, absolutely. When you have a bubble butt like that, you got to get it smacking.
Have a great time. Ow.
And he did. And what's great about this scene is while they are in these incredibly vulnerable positions, have this conversation because Michael is trying to get this date sorted with Tracy for Barbarossa's party. And Dr. David Cameron is noticeably annoyed.
Well, because he's done it before. He used to be in the closet and he was married. So he's got a unique point of view.
Right. He knows that Michael is not doing any favors by stringing Tracy along. That he understands that this job is important, but it's at the expense of Michael's own personal truth.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Michael's, I think, youth comes through, because he's like, what am I supposed to do? I can't.
That's another situation where a 30-year-old guy has like no idea how to behave as a human being. And we've talked about that in the past, where Michael ends up in situations where he's just a buffoon and they play it off as he's never left Pittsburgh. It's like the first time he goes to the country, it's like, I went to a dairy in third grade.
God, how good fresh air smells.
When was the last time you were in the country?
We visited a dairy in the third grade.
That's a long time.
The writers continually are putting Michael into this funny position where he is not just not world-wise, he is completely oblivious to everything around him. And I hate the way that they write that character. I think the writers could have done a much better job putting some more introspection into Michael and less making him just seem as if he's never done anything in his life.
Like, I understand him being a little bit naive in some areas, but when you are literally almost 30, you've had to have lived some life.
Right.
Especially considering all that he has done on Liberty Avenue.
Yeah.
Like, he should be world weary in some way, you know.
Or world wise.
Something.
I also wanted to mention the actor Chris Potter. He plays Dr. David Cameron. I don't think we've mentioned his name before. He was also on The Young and the Restless.
He was also on Kung Fu with David Carradine. That was the first thing I realized. I was like, oh my God, you're from Kung Fu. And you're like pounding this guy in the woods. This is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Dr. David was probably, for me, the most interesting love interest of Michael. I kind of lost interest in some of his other future gentlemen, but we'll cover those when we get to them.
But right now, full Dr. David Cameron fan.
So let's talk about my favorite scene now, which is when Brian brings home the hot Cajun hunk named Hotlanta.
This actor,
you know who it is?
I had.
What's he credited as?
That's what I was. I just saw this. This actor, as soon as he started opening his mouth, he had one of the worst Southern accents I think I've ever heard. It was just selling it way too hard.
What you making? Smells good.
His accent was, it had to have been a little further south than Atlanta.
Yeah.
He was Cajun. He wasn't Hotlanta.
The only reason and he is credited as Hotlanta is because he has a shirt that said Hotlanta. When Brian picks him up and brings him to the loft, we see that Justin has tried to make jambalaya for dinner and has made a catastrophe of Brian's kitchen.
Designer kitchen.
And Hotlanta opens his mouth and he's talking about the jambalaya.
Well, my boyfriend and I, we make jambalaya all the time. We just cook and fuck.
Yeah, my mom used to make a jambalaya.
He has turned on some sort of Cajun Louisiana
racism. Almost.
I was just like, what is going on?
The scene was funny.
It also bugged me the way. So you know, he's trying to do this and he's trying to be friendly with Justin. Meanwhile, Brian is like, wait a minute, are you here for the jambalaya? Are you here to fuck with me?
Now you can either stand around here eating jambalaya, you can come upstairs and eat my ass.
Remember, Brian lives in a loft, so there's not really any other rooms.
Yeah, it's not upstairs, it's like two steps up.
And he literally opens the panels to his bedroom, and Hotlanta goes down on him with Justin watching.
I like that. I really like the way that played out because Justin has this bizarre look on his face where it was unclear if he was totally turned on by it or if he's dismayed by it. He wanted to be that one. He wanted Brian to be eating his jambalaya. But
is that what Justin calls his ass?
Jambalaya.
He calls his ass jambalaya.
Did you notice that in Brian's loft, his bedroom is really like a stage? Everything around it is the audience, and the bedroom is elevated. It's in the center. It has a curtain.
It has the point of focus.
In these little spinning panels. And that's the whole focus of Brian.
Is the bedroom. And it makes perfect sense
on that part.
Justin really can't take much more. He watches a little bit of it, and then he's out.
I hope he at least put the jambalaya in the refrigerator.
It's now time for the Barbarossa party. And Bob and Betty, is it?
Betty Barbarossa.
Betty Barbarossa. Michael's at the party, and Tracy is there doing great reconnaissance as, unwittingly, the beard for Michael.
Yeah.
And Bob was unaware that they were even dating and brings Betty Barbarossa, you know, his wife, over. And she thinks Tracy's just the most adorable thing and wants to know when they're going to get married. And I'm like,
that happened in like 10 seconds. How does Betty Barbarossa know so much after like just a couple seconds of meeting them?
Right. And like this is again why I feel like this whole scene, this whole thing with Barbarossa feels like it comes out of a different era, you know?
Yeah. There was a little bit of kind of changing of the guard going on because Andrew, Michael's coworker, was there also. And he came across as just super smarmy. Like creepy and weird, but
right, because he puts on a very veiled threat
to Michael
about, you know, he's like, oh, I didn't realize you and Tracy were a thing. It's like, well, we're trying to keep it under wraps. Like, yeah, you should hear the rumors they're saying about you.
Yeah.
Especially for someone who wants to get a promotion. It's like, you either have dirt or you're ready to expose him in some way.
But he's telling the wrong person. It's right. Like that conversation, if he really wanted to do something about it, should be with Bob and Betty, not putting Michael on notice like, I know what you're up to.
Right. You literally are just giving him the upper hand on how to like continue to cover it up.
Yeah, it was a very weird scene. It was awkward, but it also furthered the storyline of Michael and his beard and Michael not being out at work.
Poor Tracy.
Yeah, poor Tracy.
That poor girl.
She's light on heavy days. Heavy on light days. So we got to, of course, push in a lesbian marital bliss scene here.
Yes, Lindsay and Mel are living the charmed life for us to then reveal that Justin has stayed over.
Oh, they were about to go at it on the dining room table. And then, oh, wait, we have Justin over. I forgot.
and Justin, you know, wakes up and he thanks them for being able to stay.
There's another underwear check here with Justin. They were kind of bad-fitting boxers. He must sleep in
those.
That's
why he got kicked out.
I wonder what Atlanta had on.
Nothing, probably.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see that Lindsay and Mel taking this kid in.
It was nice to see something happen in the show that wasn't completely fed to us. They just cut over to Justin on the sofa. There wasn't any story going into it because we were able to fill in the blanks. We knew it. We didn't have to be fed that entire story that he left Brian's house and wandered the streets trying to figure out where to sleep and decided.
And then has like a random run-in with Lindsay and has a sob story and blah, blah. No,
yeah, none of that. I just like the way that they cut it together where he was just there and we didn't need to see everything leading up to that. All we needed to know is that he was comfortable enough to ask them if he could crash there.
So now that it's next day, we have Michael at the store.
Yeah, again, it must have been a hell of a party. Everybody comes into work the next day and decisions are made.
Yeah, I mean, Michael must have slayed because Michael gets the promotion.
Well, after all, isn't that what you do when you get a promotion? Mr. Manager!
Mr. Manager! Now I'm very curious to see what goes on with Andrew since he didn't get the promotion.
Tracy comes out and just plants one right on the lips with Michael. I think Tracy had Michael's cheeks squeezed together there. And his eyes were rolling a little bit. But he gets promoted. Tracy thinks that she has a boyfriend. Debbie is going to have money now to save the house. So let's pick Justin up from school.
Justin is about to get picked on and possibly beaten outside of school when Brian arrives.
Oh, God, the extra casting.
Hey, Justin. Heard you're not living at home anymore, huh?
Yeah, fucking Daphne in her big mouth.
Yeah. Daphne. Maybe it's because you're a fucking faggot.
Yeah, because you're a fucking...
Home. Why is it whenever we need a street tough, they have to be so, like, super Long Island or super New York? And I'm like, you're in Pittsburgh. Calm down.
Yeah. That extra was...
Was extra.
Yeah. And basic.
Basic extra.
Definitely not on fleek.
I don't think that's said anymore, Patrick.
Should we? Brian suddenly showing up and orders Justin into the car. Justin looks obviously excitable. And it's like, hey, my Prince Charming's here. And then dun, 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 we're in the Taylor family estate. Which starts an incredibly awkward scene that I don't quite understand how it was even put together. We have Craig, who had beat up Brian. We have Jennifer, who pawned off Justin, and we have Justin in the middle, and all these characters are having this back and forth scene. It was shot well, and they were able to get good coverage on everybody and keep the scene moving. Once again, I loved how Craig would squirm every time Justin mentions getting fucked. He's just so appalled by it.
that's the thing. I think this had to be a Jennifer thing.
A Jennifer led meeting.
Yes. Because because she lays down the law really quickly.
So you think Jennifer like arranged this with Brian? Yes. Or do you think Brian picked him up?
I really think she did because of the way that she bust into his office. She's like, you want an out? I'll give you an out. Get my son and we're going to talk this out. I really think she did this because she's the one fully leading this meeting because like Craig tries to make a comment after Justin makes, you know, reference mm-hmm. to him having some sort of homosexual encounter. And she's like, I'm not done talking. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like they left something out in this. Like, all of a sudden they're just in the living room. Why did Brian pick him up? I don't know. I wasn't
because he wouldn't. Justin wouldn't go if his mother picked him up. So she used the thing that could be enticing to him.
Brian.
She uses Brian to go get him, brings him home, and she says, "I want you to come home, and we're gonna work this out." And Craig, who just can't sit with his mouth shut
without having a drink in his hand either,
has to make a comment saying that you are not going to live this disgusting lifestyle and you are never to see him again.
One more thing, Justin.
Craig.
No, I'm going to say this. If you're going to live in this house, there's rules you have to obey. You are not to go to gay bars or talk about your disgusting lifestyle. And you are never ever to see him again.
That's one way to set Brian off.
And I was like, oh.
Yeah, I thought Craig was going to come over and take another swing at Brian, or like go get the car and drive it into the living room and run him down. The weird thing about this scene, though, is that Brian seemed to be trying to solve his own problem by getting Justin out of his loft and back into the house. Yeah. So I don't think it was entirely altruism on Brian's part.
No, what solidified it was when Craig opened his mouth.
Yeah.
And I think that's what set Brian off. Like, if Craig didn't say anything and it was Jennifer leading the whole thing, I think Brian would have left that house alone.
Right.
But with Craig being as ignorant as ever, with no change in who he is.
They had a great exit where Brian gets up to leave and says,
so in other words, for Justin to live here with you, he has to deny who he is, what he thinks, and how he feels.
Don't ask for your opinion, pal.
Well, that's not love. That's hate.
Get the fuck out of my house.
Justin, you coming?
So, as usual, we have to wrap everything up in some communal scene. So, let's go to the diner. Let's hang out. Vic's there. Vic all of a sudden looks like he just ran a marathon. He looks very healthy.
Well, it's because he no longer carries the weight of feeling responsible for the condition of Debbie. But mm-hmm. they're celebrating Michael's promotion, but it's eating at Michael because he's gotten the promotion under very false terms.
I'm a liar. And don't tell me I should be used to that, Mike.
That's not what I was going to say. What I was going to say is, it's not lying if they make you lie. The only truth they can accept is their own.
That worked. That little clip worked pretty well. So everybody's congratulated Michael. It's time to go. Justin and Brian go back to the loft. This is the final scene of the episode, and it was a lovely little scene between Brian and Justin. And again, it's everybody rooting for Justin. They want to see this happen. I don't know of too many people that are anti-Justin yet. Viewers, that is. And so you see a little bit of a win for Justin, and Brian grudgingly loves the jambalaya. But more importantly, he seems to be enjoying the moment with Justin. This first time that we ever see Brian sitting down in his home, sharing a meal with somebody that's as close as anybody has ever come to being his boyfriend. What pulled the scene together was a song by Paul Oakenfold underneath it. As usual, the streaming version completely altered it. But the song was All I Want Is All I Need. It tied the whole scene together, and there was a pull-away shot where you just see them enjoying one another's company. And then the episode ended. So This episode was a little bit of a rollicking car ride.
This episode also ended without going to Babylon.
Yeah.
Every episode we have seen thus far ends with a scene in Babylon. And here we end with a simple dinner between Brian and Justin. And I find that significant. I think maybe this, because of the events that have unfolded in the past couple of episodes with Justin's family, that this is quite possibly a turning of the tide when it comes to the Brian character.
So let's recap this episode. Does it hold up? So my vote's going to be yes, but there really wasn't much to this episode. It was sort of a bulletproof sitcom type of thing. The music was timeless with Madonna and Paul Oakenfold. Both of those songs, I think most people would recognize these days, even if you couldn't name them. Hotlanta was overacted, but it's very typical of 90s sitcoms with a laugh track. So I'd say, yeah, it does hold up because it didn't really like offend anything.
I'm going to be a no on this episode.
Ooh, again?
Yes.
That's two in a row.
I'm another no. And I'll tell you what really pushed it over the edge for me. It was the storyline and the way they portrayed Michael's deception at work with Tracy. If it was a stylistic choice to show the much more conservative traditional value of the Big Q and the Barbarossa party, but like it just seemed like, well, we have to show that he's still in the closet, and so here are some real stock characters with Betty Barbarossa asking, you know, oh, you're together? When are you getting married? It's like, well, how do you know that they've been together a long time? You know,
yeah.
Why is it that they have to be married? You know, it's just a lot of expectation that feels like it comes out of nowhere. It's 2001. It's okay to be a single man, but like there's such a push of the traditional that it's starting to ring false for me, especially when Michael is being very out in the open, and hell, even Tracy has seen him out in the open on Liberty Avenue. So this charade is just not working for me anymore. That's just getting at me so much that I can't say that this episode holds up.
Maybe that's why I thought it was a little bulletproof, because it didn't offend me quite as much as it did you. It had elements of almost Brady Bunch type of script where everything gets tied up into a nice bow.
Yeah, and that's not a compliment. I wouldn't want to be called the Brady Bunch episode.
But it did come together with great music, so there's that. Okay, next week we'll be talking about episode number 9 from season 1 called Daddy Dearest, Sonny Boy. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.